Hi there. Welcome to the Second Adolescence Podcast. Here, we talk about all things queer healing and second adolescence. So what is second adolescence, you might ask? Second adolescence is a sort of developmental life stage queer people navigate in our post-coming out adult years after growing up within an anti-queer world. For many, second adolescence is about healing the wounds of our younger queer selves, gaining the experiences they missed out on, and unlocking what it means for us to exist as our most free and true selves. I am your host, Adam James Cohen, psychotherapist and human who went through his own second adolescence. On this week's episode, we have writer Jared Dixon, who uses he-him pronouns. Jared is a conversion therapy survivor, and this conversation is really all about this. Jared really lets us in to what it was like going through conversion therapy and what healing from this has meant. And just a heads up for folks, this conversation, as you know, is going to be about conversion therapy, navigating through religious trauma, as well as the experience of suicidal ideation. And so if any of those topics are particularly sensitive for you right now, feel free to do whatever you need to take care of yourself. But this conversation was truly so powerful, and I am so touched and inspired by Jared for really turning his experience as a CT survivor into purpose through both his award-winning debut novel, Corrupted, The Truth Shall Be the Nail in Your Coffin, as well as the work he does with the nonprofit organization CT Survivors, a support group that provides holistic peer support for survivors of conversion therapy. It's truly inspiring what Jared has done on the other side of such a difficult experience. And I just feel so grateful that he was open to coming on and sharing about his story with us. And as with each episode of Second Adolescence, I really want to invite you as listener to listen with open curiosity, knowing that each of our stories are different and unique. You might hear some guests share things that really differ from your experience, whereas other guests might share things that really speak to what you went through or are currently going through. And I really hope that all of this happens and that together we can continue growing and expanding our awareness of what life and queerness and healing can be for folks. If after the show you want to connect further, feel free to head on over to secondadolescencepod.com for show notes and more, or you can follow the show on Instagram at Second Adolescence Pod. All right, welcome to the conversation. Thank you so much for being here. Welcome to Second Adolescence. Let's just dive right in. Before going anywhere, I always like to invite guests to, before kind of sharing about themselves and their story, to give a little, just a mini snapshot to who they are, just to ground the listener in a better understanding of who the person is behind the voice. So when you're in spaces like this and you're kind of introducing yourself, how would you start that?
Yes. So my name is Jared Dixon. I am an author. I am a conversion therapy survivor. I work with a nonprofit called CT Survivors, which provides holistic support for survivors of conversion therapy and religious trauma. I am just really passionate about the work I do. I believe it's my mission and my calling to really help people who have gone through conversion therapy to heal and to become whole, well-rounded, happy individuals. I want to share with people that, you know, there is life outside of conversion therapy. There is life past your trauma. It doesn't have to be a period, right? It can be just a footnote in your story. It's something that doesn't have to define you. It's something that you can overcome with the right support.
Absolutely. And I just want to really say up top how much I appreciate you coming on to invite folks into your own story. Too many people are affected by conversion therapy and are survivors of it. And at the same time, I think there are also a good amount of folks within our greater queer community who it hasn't touched, and maybe they don't have as much awareness of really what goes on. And so I just so appreciate you coming onto the show to talk about all of this and to use your story as an example. And I'm so eager to hear about all the other work you're doing as well. And so if it's okay, I'd love to kind of use the conversation today to be a bit of both about, on one hand, hearing your story, but also anything more you'd like to share to invite listeners to expand our own awareness about what conversion therapy is and the impacts that it can have on folks.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Well, why don't we start kind of with your own story, if that's okay? I'm curious, maybe just to go back in time, like, where did your story begin? Where did you grow up? What was that context like?
Okay, so I was born and raised in Maryland. I grew up in Prince George's County, Maryland, which is about 15 to 20 minutes outside of Washington, D.C. I was raised in the Methodist faith. That's where I was baptized. That was my first exposure to church. And we were active in the Methodist church for about 3 years. And then we switched churches and started going to a Baptist church where my piano teacher was actually the first lady. Her husband was the pastor and she was the first lady. And we had a really good relationship. And she kind of invited my family and me to kind of start coming to church. So we joined that church in about 2002. And that was when I started to hear a lot of messages from the pulpit about the evils of homosexuality. It was a very conservative church. There were very strict gender norms. Women were expected to wear dresses. Men were expected to wear suits. And I just remember hearing our pastor talk about how the church was being infiltrated with gays and lesbians, and he thought that that was an attack on the body of Christ. So I'm sitting here at like 13, 14 years old, and I know that I'm different. I know that I like guys, and that was just a really difficult message to hear. Yeah. And I remember just asking God, like, why did you make me this way? Like, why am I this way? Why do I have to deal with this? Make me straight. Take this away. Mm. It's such a common prayer that a lot of queer youth that were raised in religious households pray. They desperately want to be anything but queer because they know that there's a stigma attached to it. They know that it's not going to be accepted in their community, in their church, in their family, and they don't want to be ostracized. So I was really active in the church. I played the piano. I sang in the choir. Church was kind of my whole life. It was really all I knew. It was where my support system was. Right. And the thought of that just evaporating really shook me to my core.
Right. Because it sounds like for your entire upbringing, the church was your community. It was your people.
Right.
It was your so much of your world. So then, gosh, I'm picturing you then at 13, where you're getting then these direct messages from your community that this aspect of who you are is so deeply not okay. Like, that's got to be just so deeply complicated for a 13-year-old to hold, of both belonging to this place that it sounds like had a lot of like support and love for many years. And but then at the same time, then now there's this other factor. Gosh, yeah, what was that like to be kind of holding both of those feelings?
It felt like I belonged, but simultaneously was an outcast.
Wow.
So yeah. I felt a part of the community, but then I didn't. So I was trying to reconcile those two feelings because it was such a dichotomy of being so enmeshed in this community, this culture, and at the same time realizing that there's a part of me that I just could never share with anyone, because if I did, I was pretty much going to be asked to leave, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, the pastor made it very clear, you know, gays and lesbians in the church is harmful. So it really just caused a lot of anxiety and depression. I remember like struggling with depression and anxiety as early as like 12 and 13 years old because of these messages that I was hearing in the pulpit.
Right. What did that look like for you outside of church? Was it tough being at school? Was it tough being with friends? What were these other aspects of your life like when you're kind of in the church, this anxiety and depression's building? What was life like for you outside of the church?
At school, it was awful. I went to a Catholic school and I was pretty much hearing the same messages. It wasn't as harsh and condemning as the messages I was hearing in church. But they were still messages of, this is a part of you that is unacceptable to God. So I just remember always feeling like I was on guard and always trying to make sure that people didn't pick up on the fact that I was different, that I liked guys. But of course, there was only so much masking I could do. And people just automatically picked up on the fact that I was different. And that's when the teasing and the bullying and the being excluded started to occur. I just felt like no matter where I go, no matter what I do, I just cannot win. I cannot catch a break. I'm hearing messages in school. I'm hearing messages in church.
Yeah.
And I just didn't feel safe anywhere. Didn't feel safe talking to anybody at school. I definitely didn't feel safe talking to anybody at church. So I kept it all to myself.
Ooh, gosh, that's beyond isolating and beyond lonely, probably. Holy moly.
It is. It is. Yeah.
Wow. How did younger you get through that period? Goodness.
I honestly don't know.
Right.
I do believe that there was something greater at work because that's the only way I can describe it. To be able to show up to school and to church and to fulfill your obligations, it took a lot out of me. It really did.
Yeah.
But I found some type of fortitude to keep going and to kind of convince myself that maybe it would get better in some way. Maybe this wouldn't be my life. I didn't know what that would look like, to be honest. All I knew was that I just had to get through this period.
Right.
I just had to get through middle school. I just had to get through high school. And then things were going to make sense. That's what I told myself. If I could get through middle school, if I could get through high school, things would start to slowly make sense.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So.
Wow. And so then what did happen next as you're kind of trying to just get through middle school and high school?
What came next was a kind of like newfound determination to be the best at anything I put my mind to. I really turned a lot of the turmoil I was feeling, the inner angst I was feeling, and I turned it into motivation to excel academically, to excel musically. And I was just determined to get out. I honestly was relieved when I graduated high school. A lot of people were like, oh my gosh, this is the end. This is so sad. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm getting out. I'm getting ready to go to college. I'm getting ready to figure out what I'm doing with my life and what I'm doing in this world. So I used a lot of that inner turmoil and angst to just push myself to be the best. And I got a full scholarship to college. I majored in engineering, and I just knew that I needed to have like a stable job. I knew I needed to be able to support myself. I wanted to be independent. And while I was in college, I took a job as like a worship leader at a church. And it was during this time in college that I was slowly starting to whisper to myself, I'm gay. I remember at 19 telling myself, yeah, you're gay. You're not straight.
Wow. What was that moment like?
It was a very quiet moment.
Yeah.
It was a very intimate moment.
Yeah.
It was something that felt peaceful to finally be able to admit that just to myself, because I never even admitted it to myself before that. You know, for 18 years, I was like, no, I'm straight. And for the first time at 19, whispering to myself, I'm not straight, I'm gay. I think I've always been this way. And there was a sense of calm that kind of came over me. And I remember also telling myself, but I'm not ready to come out yet. And that didn't happen for another 2.5 years when I came out to my parents. I remember coming out to my mom. It was December 30th, 2010. I am never going to forget that date for as long as I live. I was home for Christmas break. We were having a discussion. It was around mid-afternoon, I want to say 2:30, 3 o'clock. And I told her that I have a friend that I like had reconnected with from high school. And she was like, oh, okay. Why did you reconnect with him? And I was like, I came out to him. I'm gay. And mind you, she was shocked. She was like, oh. And I'm thinking to myself, you didn't know? Like, I was confused. I'm thinking to myself, I've never had a girlfriend. I've never dated a girl, like never went out on a date with a girl. When I was 19, I took the bus, because I didn't drive, to see Sex and the City, the movie, the day it came out. What straight man does that? Like, you had to have known. Mm. But she said she was shocked. And she just started telling me, you know, if you go down this path, this is what's going to happen. And it became clear in that moment that this was not going to be okay.
Wow. Yeah.
I think there was a lot of fear within her that she didn't realize she had when it came to gay people, when it came to the LGBTQ community.
Mm.
And it probably terrified her that I was going to be part of a marginalized group, that I wasn't going to be able to do things that quote unquote normal people would do. I think on some level too, she was also grieving the fact that I might not be able to have kids. I might not be able to just do things that straight people honestly take for granted. Like get married, have kids, live a kind of a carefree life, you know? It's crazy just thinking back to that time, how terrified I still was about coming out. Because I like literally knew nothing about LGBTQ life, LGBTQ culture. Mm-hmm. I was really sheltered. Mm-hmm. I didn't go out in college. I didn't have a car until I was a senior. You know, the most I would do was go to the movies.
Mm-hmm.
So I hadn't experienced what it was like to be out and gay. And that coupled with my parents' fear pushed me into conversion therapy.
So yeah, how did that come about?
Okay. I came out to my mom on a Thursday. I came out to my dad on a Sunday, and that didn't go well either.
Mm.
They were both kind of grasping at straws, trying to figure out what do we do?
Mm.
And they were both convinced that being gay was just not normal. It was some type of mental disorder. It was some type of psychological disorder that you could fix. And my dad found a conversion therapist on a website of the church he was attending at the time.
Mm.
And the program was called the International Healing Foundation. And it was led by a conversion therapist by the name of Richard Cohen. Richard Cohen was a therapist that had been expelled from the ACA, I think it's the American Counseling Association, for an ethics violation back in 2002. But he was still counseling, you know, people and quote unquote converting them. And I remember watching the video. And at this time, I was in such a state of shock. And I was having severe like panic attacks and having trouble sleeping and eating and just living my life that I just agreed to do it.
Mm.
I kind of gave up and just said, okay, I'll do it. And I remember calling the person that would be my therapist, Chris Doyle, and talking with him that night. And he was just telling me, you know, our program, you know, it has an 85% success rate. You know, I'm proof that change is possible. You know, he touted the fact that he had a wife and two kids as proof that you can change from gay to straight. And that's when my conversion therapy process started. In January of 2011, I had 9 group therapy sessions. And what we would do was call a number, punch in an access code, and introduce ourselves by our first name only. And Chris Doyle was the leader of the group. He was, quote unquote, the facilitator. And there were 9 of us. We were immediately instructed to not refer to ourselves as gay or queer or any word that was associated with the LGBTQ identity, because we were trying to shed that identity. So we were instructed to call ourselves men with unwanted same-sex attraction. And essentially, Chris was telling us how homosexuality is all about not getting your emotional needs met from the same sex. It could be from a same-sex parent. It could be from peers. He pretty much told us that our need for validation and affirmation from the same sex has taken on a sexual component. Our needs essentially became sexualized because we never received healthy male validation growing up. So if your father was absent or distant, if you didn't bond with your classmates at school that were male, that all contributed to your same-sex attraction.
Wow. Do you remember resonating with that, believing that? Do you remember rejecting that? Like, what do you remember when you were first exposed to that theory? How did younger you receive that?
Once again, I was experiencing this dichotomy of that kind of was my experience, but at the same time, I always knew I felt this way from like the age of 5 or 6. Like I remember having these feelings long before the bullying began, long before any of that trauma started, long before I heard those messages. Mm-hmm. And I just couldn't shake that. Mm. I couldn't let go of the fact that I had these feelings for as long as I can remember. Clearly, the fact that I was bullied, or the fact that, you know, my dad and I weren't that close, clearly that just wasn't the issue. Mm. And that wasn't the reason why I was gay. Mm. And during this time, we were instructed to read a book called Coming Out Straight, which Richard Cohen had written in 2000. Mm. And he essentially just said some awful things about the queer community. He cited an erroneous statistic that pretty much said that gay men were more likely to molest children. Hmm. And that statistic was something that I never forgot. Oh. Like out of everything I read in that book, that one stuck out the most. Hmm. And it wasn't until after my sessions ended with Chris Doyle that I found out that he had used a discredited source to come up with that statistic. Mm. You know, he used a source that was just not credible. Mm. And it didn't take away the pain. It didn't take away the trauma of feeling like I could be a child molester if I accept the fact that I'm gay. Mm. Throughout the conversion therapy sessions, we were given a set of rules that we had to follow. The first one was that, you know, you have to stop all of your sexual behavior with the same sex. Mm. So, you know, if you're in a relationship, you need to end it. If you're having sex, you need to stop. Mm. If you're masturbating, you need to stop. Mm. We were instructed to distance ourselves and really just cut ties with friends that we had who are gay or queer or even like gay affirming. Mm. And we were instructed to surround ourselves with people who were supportive of our efforts to change. So these are men who know your struggle but support your efforts to change. These are people who are going to be with you on this journey. He was really kind of pushing us to surround ourselves with men who were just secure in their masculinity. Mm. And to really form these relationships with them, because that way we'll learn how to be men as well. So conversion therapy was just a complete and utter traumatic experience.
Gosh.
I remember feeling excruciatingly depressed. Mm. To the point where I could not get out of bed. I remember self-medicating with alcohol. Mm. I remember being suicidal and one day just deciding that I like didn't want to live.
Wow.
It was spring break. I was halfway through my conversion therapy. I go to a liquor store, I buy a bottle of vodka. I come home, I lock my door, I drink it straight, and I black out.
Mm.
And I really believe that I wanted to end my life that night.
Wow. Yeah.
I'm lucky I survived that. Mm. I'm very fortunate to have lived through that and to have been able to come out the other side. But the journey to self-acceptance was a long one, and it was fraught.
Right.
With a lot of bumps and a lot of bruises.
Yeah.
And a lot of highs and lows. And it took me a good 9 months to come out again as gay.
Uh-huh.
I was questioning my sexuality for 9 months during the time I was in conversion therapy.
And so you were in the conversion therapy that whole time?
Well, it was a 9-week period I was in conversion therapy.
Okay.
But for the months that followed, I was in a state of confusion.
Gosh.
I didn't know if I was gay. I didn't know if I could change this. I was just so confused. But one thing was very certain, which was that I wanted to live. I did not want to die. Mm. And I wanted to find a way through this. Mm. I wanted to find a way to live. So I told my dad in August of 2011, this is about 4.5 to 5 months after my conversion therapy ended, I told him, I'm like, I'm not going back. I know I had reached out to Chris about one-on-one sessions, but this is it for me. I got to figure out a way through this. And I really started to figure out who I was. I mean, I had no choice. I wasn't ready to come out again at that time. It took me another couple of months before I was able to kind of come out again to friends and to say like, no, I'm still gay. Yeah, conversion therapy didn't make me straight. I'm still gay.
And how do you remember feeling in that round of coming out? Because I can imagine for some folks, because this conversion therapy just sounds so deeply traumatic. How were you holding your own identity at that point when you were coming out again to these folks that I'm still gay? What was that like?
It was scary, to be honest, because I was going forward and learning about myself in a way that I had never done before.
Right.
I never experienced what it was like to be gay. I was terrified. I'm like, so what's next? How do I start dating? How do I meet people? How do I find my community? How do I make sense of this? You know, what's next? And I had to figure that out. And that's where I discovered that I had to share my experience in some way. That's where the writing came in. I just was like, okay, this thing happened. What am I going to do about it? Huh. How am I going to turn this into something that could help myself and help people who are also going through this?
Because at that time, were you seeing conversion therapy as only harmful? Like, was that where you wanted to try to highlight then? Or when you say you wanted to use writing to help yourself and help others, what were you seeking to help folks with?
I wanted them to know that conversion therapy is utterly harmful and is a despicable, reprehensible practice that should not exist.
Right.
And I was convinced that the practice was harmful based on a book I had read called Anything But Straight by Wayne Besson. And in the book, he beautifully outlines the lies, the scandals, the fallacies of conversion therapy. And just doesn't focus on the religious aspect of conversion therapy, because a lot of people focus on the religious aspect of it, you know, the pray away the gay, the casting out of the demon of homosexuality. They focus on that and they focus on how harmful that is, but they don't focus on the fact that you have licensed psychotherapists who believe that a person's sexual orientation or gender identity / expression can be changed. And that, to me, is more insidious than the pray away the gay people, than the religious aspect of conversion therapy. Don't get me wrong, the religious aspect is still just as harmful, but so is the quote-unquote talk therapy, the psychotherapy that, you know, licensed professionals practice. And that was my mission as a writer, to highlight the insidious practice of conversion therapy. And with that came my first book.
Yeah, tell me about that. Tell me about starting to write that book and how it evolved from when you just first started writing to becoming, I need to put this in a book.
Yeah. So I remember it was like 2013. I started to think about how I could write a novel about conversion therapy that would make people want to read it. I wasn't crazy about writing a memoir. I wanted people to be informed, but also entertained. And I landed on a title in like 2014 called Corrupted, because the practice of conversion therapy is at its core corrupted.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, okay, now what do I do? I knew that I wanted to talk about conversion therapy from both angles, from the people that oppose it and the people that have lived through it and the people that support it. So I created a complex multi-narrative novel where the main character is coming home after trying unsuccessfully to be a writer in New York City. He dropped out of MIT. He moved to New York City, unbeknownst to his parents, and was reapplying to NYU's writing program. And at the beginning of the novel, he gets evicted from his apartment, loses his job, and is forced to come back home to his dysfunctional family and confront his stint in conversion therapy in the book. It happened like a year ago. The novel then follows one of the main characters' family friends, who is a Methodist pastor, who is unsure about how to tackle LGBTQ issues. Like, it's something that he doesn't know how to approach, but then he believes he received a revelation from God that told him to preach conversion to heterosexuality for the LGBTQ community. And you kind of see both of these characters trying to achieve different goals. My character, whose name is Jerry, his goal is to discredit his conversion therapist. He gets a job working for an online publication that tackles LGBTQ issues in conversion therapy, and his assignment is to discredit the practice of conversion therapy. And you have this other Methodist pastor whose name is Mark. He's trying to promote conversion therapy and is using Jerry's former conversion therapist as a resource to help promote and facilitate the continuance of conversion therapy. So the novel is the first out of six novels. I envision writing six novels. And it tackles a host of other issues too.
Yeah.
It tackles, you know, dysfunctional families. There is a crime element to it as well that is also kind of tied into conversion therapy. And it's definitely an entertaining read. I released it in November of 2019. And it won the National Indie Excellence Award for Best Book in the Sexuality category.
Wow.
And it was nominated for a Next Generation Indie Book Award in the LGBTQ category. It also won the Don Pointer Global eBook Award in the LGBTQ category. So it has been well received. I tell people all the time, you know, this book was really birthed from my experience and wanting to shed light on what I had been through and what so many other people go through. So I'm truly excited about it. I loved the process of writing it. When I did the rewrites, I was just so focused on getting them done. Like, I remember doing the rewrite of my book in like 8.5 months. I knew where I wanted my story to go. And I remember just like feverishly, like, you know, writing anywhere I could. Like, I would take a notebook with me anywhere and I would just write chapters and chapters of it, go home, type it, and then do it again. So it was definitely a labor of love. It wiped me out emotionally, for sure, because I was definitely revisiting a lot of past experiences and past trauma.
I mean, absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm curious, like, because, yeah, I can imagine, like, on one hand, there's so much service and purpose that was probably fueling writing the book. But also, gosh, as you're speaking to, in revisiting your past and navigating through this past trauma, like, I imagine, of course, this was just such a healing process too, but probably difficult. Like, yeah, could you share a bit about that side of things? How through writing the book, like what was happening for you and your own pain and your own trauma in that process?
In that process of writing the book, I found a sense of purpose. I found my voice because for the longest time, I didn't want to speak about this. I didn't want to talk about it. Just wanted to put it behind me and just move on. And, you know, for some reason that wasn't working. It wasn't serving me. It wasn't helping me move forward. I was still stuck. And it wasn't until I revisited those moments and the entire experience of conversion therapy did I really find healing. I believe there's a quote that says, "The only way out is through." That was so true in this case.
Yeah.
I had to sit with the discomfort in order to move past it. Mm. I had to not live and breathe it, but almost like re-experience it in order for it to stop having power over me. Mm-hmm. Because the more I fought to just forget about it and just move on, you know, let the past be the past, the more it controlled me, the more the experience hampered my own growth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it was definitely a journey for sure.
Absolutely. Totally. And is this book something your parents have read, or I'm curious, what's their reaction to this work?
My dad read it and my mom read it. My dad was like, oh, wow, you can write.
Mm.
And in the past couple of years, we've gotten closer than we've been probably our entire lives.
Whoa, how'd that happen? Wow.
I think it was in part due to this book. I don't think he had fully comprehended what conversion therapy did to me.
Mm.
It took him reading this book to say, oh, wow, okay, so I was really wrong.
Wow.
And my mom read the book. She was more concerned with the fact that there was a lot of profanity in it. But she was proud of me nonetheless. Mm. And I would still say that the process of mending the relationship with my mom is still ongoing.
Mm-hmm.
I have to accept and make peace with the fact that, you know, when I was encouraged to go to conversion therapy by my parents, they were in part just scared. They were terrified for the type of life I would be living.
Mm.
And this is what I believe. They just wanted me to have the best life possible with the best opportunities.
Mm.
And they couldn't see me having the best opportunities as a gay man.
Mm.
And I have to accept that. And I have to understand that what happened to me was wrong, but it also happened for a reason.
Mm.
Sometimes I'm like, but it hurts so much.
Totally. And I can imagine being so angry. Like,
yeah.
Even I, as like someone who's just meeting you, as you were telling your story, I was feeling so angry for younger you who had to navigate that. So how do you not hold anger and rage and grief in when you're in this process of trying to heal? Goodness. Ugh.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's still a work in progress.
Of course.
You know, I'm still in therapy. I recommend everybody to be in therapy.
Mm-hmm.
I am an advocate for therapy because therapy has really helped me set boundaries. It's helped me heal relationships. It's helped me understand myself better.
Mm-hmm.
But like one of the things that I'm working on in therapy is going back and telling my teenage self, who was obsessed with perfection and obsessed with just being the best, and saying it's okay not to be perfect because nobody's perfect.
Mm-hmm.
That perfectionism was you trying to get out of situations that were just so oppressive.
Yes.
And so terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
And you did the best that you could.
Right.
And that is definitely something that I'm working on, is going back and telling my inner child, telling 14-year-old me, 15-year-old me, that you don't have to be perfect. You don't have to please everybody. You don't have to always say the right things and do the right things. You're going to make mistakes.
Mm.
And that's okay, because that's how we learn. That's how we grow.
Mm.
If you don't make mistakes, you don't learn.
Right.
If you don't make mistakes, you honestly don't do anything, to be quite honest.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been really healing to kind of go back and do that work on my inner child, you know, going back and telling 14-year-old me and 15-year-old me that, you know, it's okay not to be perfect.
Yes. Gosh, thank you for sharing that part of your story too. I think that's a theme I see show up for so many people, whether it's perfectionism or whatever their strategy was for surviving through the period of growing up when they were either trying to find some type of value and validation in who they are because they were dealing with this deeply internalized shame and fear for queerness, or whatever their situation was. Oftentimes as an adult, so much in our own healing is like letting ourselves know, hey, actually, no, we are okay as we are. Letting our younger selves know, you were okay as you are. You didn't need to be perfect to be whole,
right,
and worthy and valuable. Oh, wow. It sounds like you're doing deeply powerful work. Whoa.
Yes.
Yes.
And I really do credit my therapist for facilitating that, because I would not be able to navigate that on my own. Let's just say that.
Yes, yes. And so, okay, so I'm hearing writing has been healing, therapy has been healing. What else has been part of healing? And also I'm thinking like, you know, have you been able to give yourself some kind of experience of kind of finding your queer self, of maybe exploring dating, exploring finding queer community or relationships where you can be yourself? Like, what are these other aspects of your own healing and growth that's happened on the other side of all this work? Yeah.
Yes. So I have to talk about my husband. My husband is amazing. He is so patient, so kind. He has this wonderful sense of humor. He can just be really silly and just do the most outlandish things. But he is one of the blessings that came out of going through conversion therapy. I met him when I was in grad school. I was looking for a tutor for a class, and one of my friends recommended him, and we became friends. And about 3 months into like knowing each other, he asked me out on a date. And our first date was on a hike to Harpers Ferry, West Virginia. And we just celebrated 11 years on Sunday.
Whoa.
We've been together for 11 years, married for almost 2 years, together for 11 years.
Wow.
And to be able to find my person, my other half, my soulmate, my best friend, has been almost like mind-blowing, because I was taught that I would never have this. I would never be in a committed relationship. I would never be able to find someone that wanted the same things or that had the same values as I had. And it's just crazy how wrong I've proven the Chris Doyles of this world, who just think that being gay is wild, crazy sex and drugs and all of these things that, quite frankly, I was never really drawn to. All of these stereotypes that didn't really fit who I was. And to be able to find my husband, to be able to build a life with him, and to talk about the future, our plans for having kids and being dads and building a family together, that is such a blessing. Because I know a lot of people don't get to have that. They don't get to experience that. So I am so incredibly blessed. I've found a wonderful community of faith. Shout out to my church, Our Lady Endure of Knots. We're a progressive Catholic church in the Baltimore area. And they've really been a source of support. You know, for the first time, I feel like I belong, truly belong in a place of worship. You know, I truly feel like in that space, God is present. In my past churches, everything just felt off because I wasn't given the permission to be authentic. I wasn't given the permission to be myself, to show up as my entire self. But now I can, you know, now I'm expected to. And that is such a joy. And then I've found an amazing group of conversion therapy survivors. We're a nonprofit called CT Survivors, and we provide holistic support for people that have gone through conversion therapy and religious trauma. We meet weekly, and to be able to help other survivors navigate life after conversion therapy, to be able to show them, okay, this is what you do. This is how you, you know, make sense of this. This is how you navigate this. That has been such a blessing to be able to give back. We just finished our draft of an anthology of conversion therapy survivor stories. And to be able to see the growth in these survivors from the time they started writing their stories to the time, you know, they finished has been just amazing. It's been astounding. It really does show that writing is a powerful tool. Writing can be a healing tool. It can be a part of the therapeutic process. And I'm just so fortunate to be able to share that part of myself and to be able to give back to other survivors, you know, because so many people suffer in silence.
Yeah.
And it's important for me to tell everyone that would listen that you are not alone, that what happened to you was not your fault. It was wrong. It was deplorable, but it wasn't your fault. You don't have to blame yourself for what happened to you. You did not fail yourself. You are not to blame. And also to tell survivors, there was nothing wrong with you to begin with. There was nothing wrong with you at all. There is nothing wrong with you. And you can get through this.
Mm. Wow. Jared, I am so grateful that you wanted to come on to let us all into your own story and to share your pain and to share the work that you're doing and the service you've turned your pain into. I am just so affected by you and what
thank
you're
you.
Doing. And
oh my gosh, thank you.
I ordered the book. I'm excited for it to arrive. And I guess for listeners who want to be able to follow more about what you're doing, maybe get the book themselves, like, where's a good place to direct them? I'm going to already add links to all the work you're doing with CT survivors. I'll add that into the show notes. But where else can folks go to connect?
If you want to follow me on Instagram, I am at DIJared13. If you want to order the book, you can just order it on Amazon. Mm-hmm. The title of the book is Corrupted: The Truth Shall Be the Nail in Your Coffin. Ooh. It is the first of hopefully 6 books. And you can reach out to me via like a DM, and I will point you into the direction of CT survivors. If you are a conversion therapy survivor and you want to get in touch with us, the email for that, it is conversiontherapysurvivors@gmail.com. Mm. So if you are a survivor and you're just looking for support, just email us. We will definitely get back to you and talk about next steps and just how you can be a part of our community that is healing.
Mm. Awesome. Thank you again, Jared. This was so special.
Thank you for having me. Oh my gosh. Thank you. This is an honor to be here and to share my story.
Hey, thanks for joining us for today's conversation. Feel free to head on over to secondadolescencepod.com for show notes and more. And you can connect further by following the show on Instagram at secondadolescencepod. If you're interested in being a future guest on the show and you want to come on and share about your own second adolescence, visit secondadolescencepod.com/beaguest and you can submit your interest there. All right, that's it for me for now. Whether it's morning, afternoon, night, wherever we're finding you in your day, go on out there and keep doing things that would make younger you absolutely thrilled. That is what it's all about. All right, take good care.